Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. Welcome along to episode 205 of the Early Excellence podcast. In this week's episode, we're joined by Rachel Shearer and Martin Cumming as we discuss a citywide initiative in York aimed at closing the communication and language gap in young children. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Rachel Shearer and Martin Cumming. Hiya, Rachel. Hiya, Martin. How are you doing?
Fine. Hi, Andy.
Great to see you. Thank you very much for joining us for the podcast. It's great that you could give up some of your time to be able to come on the podcast. It's brilliant. I'm really interested in your work. We've got lots to talk about in terms of your work around communication and language skills, developing and supporting communication and language skills within the City of York. Let's start with some introductions because we've got lots to get onto, but let's start with some introductions. Should we go to you, Rachel, first? Is that all right?
Yeah, sure. So, hi. Yeah, I'm Rachel Shearer. I'm a speech and language therapist, and I've worked in York now for about 25 years. I've got a real passion for early years and worked with lots of children with special educational needs in that time. And 2 years ago, I came to work with the Early Talk for York approach. So my current role involves part-time working with the NHS service and part-time working jointly with the local authority with Early Talk for York.
Very good. Thank you very much. Okay, over to you, Martin.
Hi, I'm Martin Cumming. I'm the assistant head teacher at St. Paul's Nursery School here in York. And 2 days a week, I'm on secondment working for Early Talk for York as a specialist speech and language teacher. I've been a SENCO inclusion leader for almost 10 years, over 10 years, I think now. And I've got a real passion for children with additional needs, but also those children who've got speech language difficulties within the early years.
Yeah, super. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to be talking all about your work that both of you do for Early Talk for York. Let's define what Early Talk for York is then, first of all. It's a project, isn't it? Working with schools, working with settings across the city. Can you give us a bit of a potted history, you know, the starting points for it? Would that be all right?
Yeah, sure. So it's a citywide approach. It's a jointly commissioned approach across NHS and the local authority. And the reason it started was because in 2017, York Local Authority actually had the biggest disadvantage gap, age five, between disadvantaged and non-disadvantaged children. And that gap is probably, well, maybe quite surprising for some people. But it was a bit of a wake-up call for York. And we thought, you know, what can we do about this? And it was felt that actually, obviously, one of the key things in terms of children's outcomes is communication and language. And if we could build a citywide approach that boosted children's language skills age 0 to 5, that we could hopefully close that disadvantage gap. So it started with a pilot project in the most disadvantaged part of the city with a smaller number of schools and settings, and the data that we collected from that pilot study was very compelling. There was actually a massive closing of the disadvantage gap from something like 35% gap to around 5% gap. We collected some very, very compelling evidence around boosting the environment and skilling up staff to identify speech and language difficulties and put appropriate interventions in place. So after that pilot project, it was then scaled up across the city to become a citywide approach. And we're still going.
Very yeah. Good. Okay. And in terms of the work that you do, I think Martin mentioned in his introduction, you get out and about into schools, supporting the staff in order to be able to support the children. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Talk for York's got a three-step approach, really. So the first step is we're looking at sort of screening all children annually. So we know where children are at in the early years with their speech, language and communication. And we ask that schools and settings that are screening send in their data to the local authority just so we can look and we can evaluate where we're at as a city with communication language within sort of like the early years. And we also ask settings that are working at step one to attend like network meetings. So termly we have a network meeting where practitioners, the lead practitioners, can all come together and we share good practice. We might do a little bit of training. So we do webinars throughout the year as a specialist team, helping support new practitioners to settings and things like that. But we like to try and keep staff as upskilled as we possibly can. And we also want schools and settings to be working in partnership with parents and carers as well to support like the wider development of children's needs, because it's not just us as practitioners with my practitioner hat on. It's not just as practitioners and as school teachers and things to be helping support speech, language, communication needs. It's as a team around the child, really.
Yes. And
after that sort of step one approach, we sort of have a step two approach where schools and settings start looking at training up members of staff to be sort of like communication champions almost. So we use the LPLAN approach for this, and we ask that staff have, or settings and schools have, someone trained to level three on the LPLAN approach, usually on the 3 to 5s pathway, and that helps to upskill staff. We ask that if settings are coming on board with the approach, that that level three practitioner then looks at doing the level four, which is communication friendly setting status, which is renewable every 3 years. That's sort of like a whole school, whole setting, well, a whole setting approach and a whole early years approach to communication and language, and helping support staff and upskilling staff to be able to support that communication and interaction needs within setting. And yes. Then when on that journey, we kind of get to step three, where settings and schools may achieve that communication-friendly setting. And that's kind of where we sort of more step in. So we've got around 45 schools now at step three, and the three practitioners between us. So we've got Rachel, myself, and Jenny. Rachel and Jenny as speech and language therapists, and myself as a specialist speech and language teacher. We go out and help support schools and settings termly. That might be with questions about how best to support and develop their practice, or it might be having information and just little chats and discussions informally about the children that they've got in setting, or just giving them practical tips and guidance about how to put intervention into place
to
help support those children's needs, really.
Absolutely. I think that what you were saying before about that sort of starting point, so that universal screening of language, I think is so important, isn't it? That presumably that throws up all sorts of interesting, to a certain extent, interesting data, but also kind of on a smaller level, interesting conversations and discussions about individual children and groups of children within schools and settings. Yeah. You know, so for example, you know, presumably when you do that language screening, it will also throw up potential issues in terms of hearing, for example. You know, yeah. If we haven't picked up a hearing issue with a child on entry to school before, that actually that particular screening will find that. Or if there are other issues, potential other maybe social issues, perhaps, or, you know, in terms of personal, social and emotional development or other sorts of issues. And that as a starting point, that's quite an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we use the Wellcome preschool toolkit as a screening.
Yeah.
We feel that we know that identification of language needs is really important, and that many difficulties later on in life are often linked to unidentified language needs.
Yeah.
So we absolutely think it's important to do the identification, but you're right, it's around a fuller discussion about the child.
Yeah.
Wellcome doesn't screen absolutely everything about communication and language, but it does give practitioners opportunity to think about social skills or speech sounds. But we find the combination of Wellcome and LPLAN a really powerful combination. The Wellcome is very structured, helps to break things down developmentally, and helps practitioners see that developmental progression. You can see maybe how many sections behind a certain child is or where the gaps are. It allows you to compare understanding of language with expressive skills. So that's really helpful. However, it doesn't, where our conversations come in, where the LCLAN training comes in, is that that also encourages practitioners to think about the whole child. And on the LCLAN course, they cover something called the communication chain, which breaks down communication into lots of different steps, one of which would be hearing. You know, can the child actually look ahead and hear? So I guess in our conversations, when we go into settings, Martin, we would be having those conversations. We wouldn't just be looking at the score on a screen.
No, definitely.
We're looking at, well, why is that? Is there a hearing issue? Is there something else going on? And we can have that conversation. Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. It won't give you all of the answers, but it will raise lots of questions potentially.
That's right.
And there's a starting point. That's great, isn't it? Because you then can have the conversations with parents potentially. You could have the conversations with other members of staff within the setting. You know, are you finding this when you have a conversation with this child? Are you finding that they respond in this way? Or actually, is it just one member of staff that they're not responding to? You know, it raises the questions rather than gives the answers. But actually, that's fertile ground, isn't it, as a starting point?
We find that it's a useful starter sometimes for conversations with parents who may not be aware of a language need.
Yeah.
It's quite helpful for practitioners to be able to say to parents, actually, we screen all our children. We haven't picked yours out, you know. We screen all our children, and actually it's flagged up that there's a little bit of a delay here.
Yes.
What are you finding at home? How are they communicating with you at home? And as you say, it's a useful starting point for that conversation. For children that do need to be referred on to specialist services, it can also add further information to a referral on, say, to, we have a learning support hub for children with additional needs here in York. Or if it was a specialist referral onto the speech and language therapy service, it can give a little bit of extra information or, you know, data, if you like, to those onward referrals.
Yes, it's not. It's yeah. So
good starting point.
Yeah, good starting point. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me as well is that the project itself, or the work that you do with schools in that way, it's not putting the emphasis just on you and your team. You know, you have a small team. I think you said three of you. The emphasis isn't just on your team, is it? It's on actually supporting the teachers and the practitioners within the setting to develop their skills, their understanding, so that actually all of this work has got legs. Otherwise, actually, you've got three very skilled people charging around across the city trying to do all of that work when actually, in order to really keep that going, you need, you know, that's not sustainable, is it really? You've got to have other people that you are training up in the schools. And that's the power of this, I think, isn't it? The longer this goes on, the more trained up people you've got out there in the schools, that actually they are up to speed and they know exactly how this runs.
I think also the quality of the training that we get through LCLAN, like for the level three and then the cascading to staff through the level four communication friendly setting, is absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
I know with my practitioner hat on, I know that our staff in my own setting, you know, when we've gone through some of things like the communication chain and some of those strategies that LCLAN kind of give us, and also that Welcome gives us, the impact on the children is immense, but it's also the impact on the practitioner as well, because actually sometimes you get those light bulb moments where you think, oh gosh, I don't always give a child time to think, or, you know, before they answer a question, or I use too many questions. You know, that's one of the things we look at. We look at, you know, commenting rather than questioning and things like that. And I think sometimes it's just that light bulb bing moment sort of thing with some practitioners who may not have thought about that before that has the greatest impact. And, you know, if we can upskill as many staff as we possibly can within settings to have this training or have a better understanding and a better knowledge of speech, language and communication, then, you know, we can close that gap that, you know, was one of the reasons why the approach started. But we can also just see that impact on children as they go through life, as you said, you know, it has a big impact later on in life.
Definitely. And I think what's striking for me is that when you talk about speech, language and communication skills, those are umbrella terms, if you like, that cover, as you said earlier on, Rachel, you know, they cover such a wide range of different things. And that it's only when you then share things like the communication chain that you unpick it into these little, you know, sort of minute things that we all do when we're having a conversation, but that you, as an adult, when you're having a conversation, you don't even realize you're doing it. Because it's just, you know, it becomes something that we just do. But the, you know, the eye contact and the recognition of facial expressions and that sort of forming the sounds, responding to what's been said, all of the minute things that we do when we have a conversation, that we think, well, actually, if we're going to support children to develop all of those skills, we need to have an understanding ourselves of what those smaller skills are that make up the bigger picture. And that's really complex, isn't it?
It is complex. But going back to what you were saying earlier, we know that the biggest catalyst for change is going to happen through the people that interact with the children every day, not through the specialist services going in, you know, every now and then. So, and we also know that change happens most effectively in a natural environment through play and those learning opportunities, social opportunities with friends. That's where the real communication develops and, you know, not in a therapy session. Yes. So actually, you know, going back to skilling up practitioners, this is the way to, you know, this is the way to create change across, across the whole population, is to skill up people who are working and interacting with those children on a daily basis and can bring those strategies into natural learning opportunities. Definitely. And integrate those different skills that are involved in communication and support children to use communication skills in a real, you know, real situations. Yes. And I guess what our role is in terms of the specialist team is not just, we're not just throwing some training at these staff and then saying, okay, go away and do it now. You've had your LCLAN training. Now just you go and do it by yourselves. We know that staff need support, that our role is really helping to sustain the approach. We're a sounding board. We're not there to give answers. We're there to support and skill up and, you know, coach people to come up with their own solutions. And every now and then we might have a little nugget of wisdom to share. But we know that that is what's going to create a sustainable approach and actually make a change, you know, longer term in these children's.
Definitely. What I thought we'd do is have a look at some strands in terms of EYFS practice and then share ideas, really, for people who are listening, because I know that a lot of what we've talked about already will strike a chord with many people up and down the country. That actually, when we're talking about speech, language, communication needs, the needs are there up and down the country, aren't they? And that when I think about the schools and the settings that I work with, just about every school and setting has communication and language as a key priority at the moment. And so really, to, you know, based on the work that you've done, I think it'd be really interesting to think about actually some key information, some key things to put across, some key advice, perhaps, and some key things to think about. And the way that I would always break this down is I would always break it down into three key strands, which are the child, the environment, and the adults. I think we keep it really simple and really straightforward. We say, right, this is this area of practice, this is this area of practice, and that's that area. Let's think about them individually and then think about how they link together. So the child, first of all, then, I would always say that an understanding of child development is key. You know, that idea of really understanding how young children learn and develop in terms of speech, language, and communication is crucial in terms of those small steps, you know, from birth onwards. And what does that look like? Does that come into the work? I wonder, what does that come into the work that you do?
Well, I mean, I think looking at from a sort of practitioner point of view, getting to know your children is kind of the most important thing, first of all.
Yes.
Sort of like through interaction and play. The vast majority of settings that we visit and have the privilege of going into demonstrate really great communication with children, and also like that development of play and adult-child interaction. And that's one of the, you know, one of the key focuses of like the LCLAN approach that people use. I think as a practitioner, if you have a good understanding of your child and you get to know that child, you then can link in sort of like whereabouts developmentally they're at and whether or not they are struggling with communication interaction or speech and language issues and things like that. And it's then using that knowledge to then think about what next steps we might need to use for that child. So, you know, using a tool such as Wellcom, we can identify where children are working at with their communication and language needs. We can go all the way down to, from 6 months up to, you know, almost 6.5, 7 sort of thing using the Wellcom toolkit. We can see where they're at and we can see the gaps in their knowledge and understanding. And then we can work at trying to understand how best to help support those children.
Yes.
You know, it's a journey and all of our children are completely different. And I think it's upskilling of practitioners to understand that journey is a really important feature of knowing and understanding where children are kind of working at, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just thinking post-pandemic, when speech and language communication needs, I think we saw kind of like, I don't want to say the trough, but, you know, that we saw a dip in communication and language after that. And I think through the pandemic, specialist services, getting access to specialist services was difficult. So I think upskilling of staff and especially, you know, using through the early Talk Bjork approach that we follow, you know, we've got a good understanding now of children's needs. And I think we're better at identifying now post-pandemic when a child has a need and how best to get support and help for that child. And yes. Whether that's through upskilling practitioners or through, you know, we've got in York, we've got the request for helpline to the speech and language therapy service where we can get a child triaged quite quickly. We ring up, ask for a phone call. We have a conversation about the child with parent permission. And then the children are either put on the speech and language therapy waiting list or they may get to go to a group or they might, you know, get to we might get some support over the phone, you know, some strategies to try and things like that. So yeah. I think that early identification, I think we're getting better at it.
And in terms of practice, a lot of that is about the transition processes you have in place within a setting, of course. You know, so for example, some schools, some settings will do home visits and go and meet the parent or parents and the child within the home. And it always strikes me that actually as a starting point of getting to know, you know, whether that how that child engages at home actually is really useful information, because a child will often interact differently when they're in a school or in an unfamiliar setting. But actually seeing that child interact at home will tell you quite a lot.
Absolutely. And I think parental engagement is key. I think developing that parental engagement is really key, because parents know their children best. And, you know, if they're not within a setting, they're with their parents. So, you know, having that collaborative working and having that understanding of actually at home, they're a lot more chatty than they are in setting. Okay, that might just be a confidence issue or something. Or, you know, parents at home might find, oh, I'm actually finding understanding some of their speech sounds or speech a little bit tricky. Oh, yeah, we've noticed that as well. So you're having that collaborative talk and then moving that forwards, really. I think sort of traditionally, speech and language is, if children have a speech and language issue or a need, I think traditionally as settings, we've only ever sort of brought that up in my support, my success plan meetings or, you know, my agreed outcome meetings and things like that. Yeah. But I think now we're getting far better at identifying just in general practice what a need might be and how to sort of focus in on that and how to help support that.
Yeah, definitely. The interesting thing as well is that when we talk about upskilling staff to support children in terms of communication and language needs, we're talking about closing the gap or narrowing the gap, aren't we, in terms of from disadvantaged to advantaged children. But actually, all of this work, it enables staff to support all children more effectively, doesn't it? It's not just about actually a particular percentage of the group, of the class. It's actually, you know, by doing this work, by being a better communicator and by understanding communication skills and how we develop those skills, you're in a better position to support all of your children, aren't you? I think.
I think if you know that, getting to know your children, you know which children need pushing in certain areas, which children need, you know, support in other areas. And I think this has really helped to identify that within practice. But it's the whole setting as well. I think some of the most successful schools support-wise that we see for speech and language communication is the fact that it is interweaved in everything that they do, whether it's through math, whether it's through phonics or anything. It's all about developing communication and interaction and language, really, because it's the key skill to everything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And vital. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's leave the child and child development, and we'll put that to one side for a moment. Let's move on to the environment then. And this for me is a key one, a crucial one. Within the UIFS framework, it talks about a language-rich environment. But what's always interesting to me is that I think that's a phrase and or a term that's quite often misunderstood. And I wondered whether you found that in your work. You know, do you find that actually working around what does an effective language-rich environment look like? Is that part of the work? Is that part of the work you do within the project?
Absolutely it is. And this is where it really links with the LCLAN communication-friendly setting work that we do. So settings that are going through that LCLAN communication-friendly setting look at an environment, a checklist. So they have a checklist, an audit checklist to look at, and a good chunk of that checklist is focused on the environment. So settings at the beginning of that journey actually look around their setting and they look around to see, well, what does the environment look like? What are the distractions, visual and auditory distractions? How are we labeling? How are we using visuals? Are they helpful, displayed in a clear and helpful way, or are they cluttered? How are we displaying vocabulary that we want to model? Is that in a useful, helpful way that is really prompting adults to use that vocabulary? Or again, is it in a distracting way? So we do definitely encourage practitioners, obviously as part of the LCLAN and then as part of our visits, to continue to consider the environment, the levels of background noise, how the provision is set out. And we also have support from our quality improvement team. So Early Talk for York is not just a specialist team of speech and language therapists and teachers, part of a wider strategic group across York. And we have support from the quality improvement advisors who are also going into settings and supporting them. They're aware of the elements of Early Talk for York and also, you know, reinforce the approach on their visits. So they are also great colleagues to liaise with about the environment and about how settings, you know, priorities for settings, what might be important for a particular setting at a particular time. So, yeah, absolutely. And then at the end of the communication-friendly setting training, the setting redo their audit.
Yes, great.
And, you know, they have to be getting fours or fives. You know, they have to be in the green zone for every element to pass their communication-friendly setting. And we do find that one of the things that sometimes settings are encouraged to modify is, you know, a quiet area of space. So, no, absolutely. We find that the environment does have an impact on children's attention levels, focus levels, and it definitely gets staff thinking about levels of background noise, whether they might be taught. One of the things that comes up is that sometimes adults are talking, might be talking in the background when children are trying to do a focused activity. So it raises adults' awareness of that. And they say, oh, yes, we're going to be more mindful of that. And if we're, you know, talking to another member of staff whilst a focused activity is going on, we'll try and, you know, have that conversation another time or in a quieter place. So it definitely gets staff thinking, doesn't it? And how to organise their space so that it's as communication and interaction friendly as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, I think some of that is to do with the layout of the room, you know, that you mentioned. So you can set your room out in hundreds of different ways, can't you? And some of them will be effective, some of them not quite as effective. And I always think that's quite interesting. I don't think we give that as much value as maybe we should. You know, we talk about kind of getting our room ready or setting it up, but we don't really talk about how actually, what's the difference between it being set up really well to support communication and language in terms of the structure of the room, how the, you know, where the furniture is placed, and what's the difference between that and setting it up in a way that isn't going to support communication and language? And I think we probably should have that conversation more. So I visit lots of settings where actually they have lots of furniture placed around the edge of the room, but then you see children charging all the way through the middle. And because we're not slowing children down, because we're not sort of creating those bays and corners, you end up with a lot of charging about and a lot of children distracted by everything else going on around the room. Whereas some corners and bays set out within the space both slows children down, and it also tends to lead to those cozier, more secure corners and bays where you're likely to get smaller numbers of children gathering, playing alongside one another, and that there you see the beginnings of friendships quite often. You know, the beginnings of just a bit of an eye contact or just a glance across from when they're playing alongside somebody, just a glance that, you know, this is the same child that was here yesterday in the construction area alongside me. You know, those sorts of things actually are often not talked about enough, I think, but actually they are valuable, really.
Yeah, it's creating that flow, isn't it, within a setting. So
yeah,
children can easily access where they want to be playing. But as you say, there's not that high traffic sort of storming. You know, we have spaces outside where, you know, running and things is more accessible. But within a communication-friendly space, we want to create those cozy places that conversation can happen through play, and, you know,
yes,
practitioners can help support that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's really evident to me when you go into a setting and you can almost see immediately that nearly every child is engaged in some sort of purposeful play. That often comes down to how the space is arranged, that it actually facilitates that purposeful and focused play. And when there is a purpose and a focus to the play, of course, that, you know, the language comes and the interaction comes. So, yes, I think I completely agree with you, Andy, that how that space is laid out. And if it's clear to the child, you know, what the purpose of this area is, and when it encourages those small groups of children, and then you really start to see that lovely collaborative play and children, you know, talking to each other and negotiating with each other about what, you know, what brick should we put where, etc. Those small groups really encourages that.
It does. And some of that is about human nature, isn't it? You know, that's not just about children. That's about human nature. That actually, you know, as human beings, we don't really like going into one great big space and having conversations. You know, that some people are more confident socially than others. But you know what I mean? That you kind of generally, you don't like going into a big open space. You know, if you're going to a party or something like that, we don't really like walking into a great big hall, a great big open space and having conversations across it. We actually like being in spaces that are organized for social gatherings, where often they are set out into bays and corners. Think about, you know, generally, if you go into a cozy pub or something like that, they're often set out with cozy little corners and things like that, because actually as human beings, in order to be sociable, we want to feel secure and confident, and we gather in smaller groups. And it's the same for children. You know, they need these smaller spaces to be able to get into and feel confident and to use their social skills, but in a kind of a secure, confident way on a small level, not across a great big space, really. So, yes.
We need to be aware of children's sensory differences and additional needs. And if children are having to use all their concentration just to block out some background noise, you know, that's going to take an awful lot of the brain space just dealing with the amount of background noise. So, yeah, obviously that those spaces are set up with different sensory preferences in mind as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so we've talked about the child and child development. We've talked about the environment. Let's move on to the adults then. So crucial, of course, and crucial to your work, definitely. There are a number of things here. I think from my point of view, just to kick things off, I would say it's important for adults to have an understanding that it isn't just about what's being said when we're talking about communication and language skills. That communication and language development starts from an incredibly early age. You know, so one of my favorite slides when I deliver training is I've got a slide, a black and white photograph from research, which I think was from the 1960s, could be 1970s. And it basically shows research from around that time where they researched into very young babies responding to adults' facial expressions. I don't know what might well be familiar to you. I guess it would be. And you've got these wonderful photographs of a man focusing in on a child and pulling a particular face. And then you see the child who is just probably, I think, a number of days old, basically copying this facial expression. So the man sticks his tongue out and then holds that facial expression. And then just eventually the baby will do exactly the same thing. And you see the same thing with different facial expressions. So, you know, open mouth facial expression and so on. And for me, that's the beginnings of interaction. It's that kind of, it's that serve and return, if you like, that, you know, I'm doing this, you're doing this, and back again, you know, forwards and backwards. And I think sometimes, I don't know whether you agree with this, but I find that sometimes we try to jump too quickly through the hoops. So we put pressure on ourselves as adults to have brilliant conversations with children. When actually, in reality, if you go along and in your mind, you think, oh, I'm going to go and have a great interaction with this child. If the child's not expecting you to be there and you haven't built this relationship up with them and you just suddenly appear in the home corner alongside them and you go, right, let's talk about this. The child's going to get up and walk away. And they do, you know, they're very honest. Yeah. They'll just, if they don't feel comfortable, they will just get up and walk away. Whereas the best, for me, the best interactions are where an adult has really engaged sensitively, first of all, over a longer period of time, copying what the child's doing. So, you know, in the dough area, you know, they're rolling sausage shapes, so I'm rolling sausage shapes, and they're making a ball out of the dough, so I'm doing the same thing. And you get that relationship built up, but where the child doesn't see that adult as a threat at all. They see them as somebody who is really interested and is copying what I'm doing. And that then leads into, well, am I doing it right? Did you make a sausage shape like that? Am I doing it right? I don't know how you do this. Can you show me how you do that? And you change the relationship, I think, by building that relationship. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And actually, the child, adult-child interaction strategies that we sort of pick apart a little bit more on the LPAN course pretty much focus on what not to, you know, not saying things. So we talk about, first of all, getting down on the child's level physically, spending time observing, waiting and listening, you know, observing the child in their play. What are they interested in? What do they want to do with the Play-Doh? You know, where are their interests? So following the child's lead in play, and that's how you'll build joint attention. You know, communication and interaction is based on having joint attention and a shared, you know, shared interest. So, you know, practitioners need to look at where the child's interests are. How are they? What do they want to play with? How are they wanting to play with it? They're not wanting to be told, do this with the car or whatever. So it starts with observing, waiting and listening. And like you say, then maybe doing some mirroring and some joining in. And after you've managed to establish that, you may then make a comment, again, based on what the child is doing. So you're giving language to what the child is already doing at a simple level based on the child's age and developmental level. If the child says something back, you may then model something about adding an extra word to extend their language. But we find that there are two strategies in particular that people like from the LCLAN. One is the hand rule. So the hand rule is one question to four comments, repetitions or expansions, because one of the things that we find that practitioners tend to do too much is ask too many questions. And they think that the way to get a child to speak is to ask them a question. So if you're going, oh, what colour is that? And what should we do with this? And they think, oh, if I ask questions, surely that's going to get language. How am I going to get language out of a child by effectively not saying anything? So it's sort of understandable why practitioners, especially when we get to sort of reception age, and there's a bit more of a focus on teaching, that they think that the way to sort of teach and to encourage language is to ask questions. So one of the things that we observe quite often is lots of questions, and we encourage people to use not no questions, because of course it's natural to ask some questions, but we have this hand rule, which is one question, which is your thumb. So if you put your hand up, your thumb represents sort of one question, and then your four fingers up to four, every four sort of comments or repetitions or expansions. So that's one sort of little rule that we find that practitioners like to sort of keep in mind.
Yes, I can imagine that people will find that challenging, but initially maybe think, oh, crikey, there's no way I can do that. I'm going to find that really hard. But then maybe a month later, having really tried to hold themselves to it, they find that actually they've got other tools now that they would never have used had they stuck with the questions all of the time.
Yeah, sure. And one of the things we encourage in the LCLAM training, staff can do peer observations of each other. It's not supposed to be threatening. It's you know, a supportive situation. They observe each other doing peer interactions and give feedback to each other. Oh, it was really good when you made that comment, or I noticed, you only asked one question there or whatever. So it's quite useful to have that feedback from a peer. And also, you know, just helps build practitioners' awareness of how they're interacting with children. And like you say, the more they practice it, the more it becomes natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've talked about the child, we've talked about the environment, we've talked about the adults. And so many of the things that we've just talked about come into the work that you're doing in schools, in the schools across the city, supporting the teachers and the practitioners and doing all of that valuable work. And coming back to that work, the early talk for York, tell us about the impact of it. Because, of course, you gave us a history lesson at the beginning. You talked about how back in 2017, early talk for York as a project started because actually there was that biggest gap nationally between, in terms of the city, between those that were disadvantaged and those that were advantaged. Tell us about the impact then from then to now in terms of the project, if you could.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots we could talk about here. It's been a very successful approach. Some of the most powerful impacts are those stories that we get actually from schools and settings that we've worked with. So I'll just give you one example of a school that we work with a very high level of need. And they've trained up their early years staff. And I was talking to their lead communication practitioner. And she just had this lovely example of a little boy who at 3.5 could only say a few words and was difficult to understand what he was saying. They assessed him using the Welcome toolkit. And then they started the Welcome interventions because, of course, there's intervention activities that go along with the Welcome. So they're able to start at his level and build up on that. They used LCLAN strategies to build vocabulary. They used his interests as a starting point. They did refer him to speech and language therapy services because they were quite concerned. But because of, well, there's a long waiting list. So by the time he was actually seen, he'd made a huge amount of progress. And he actually needed very little specialist support. And, you know, this teacher told me recently, you know, he's now able to access learning in reception class. He's excelling in phonics, writing and maths, and enjoying interacting and communicating with his peers. And that was a really good example of one little boy who was really quite delayed at age 3.5 and was able to get the right support at the right time. And actually, wonderful, by the time the specialist services got there, you know, there was very little that needed to be done. It was very empowering for those staff and obviously wonderful for that boy and that and his parents. And then on the other side of it, so obviously I work with the NHS service part of the week. The therapist who then went into that school, there's a knock-on effect for our specialist services because the practitioners are already skilled up and, you know, are either already doing a lot of the interventions really proficiently or actually only need little pointers and suggestions to help keep them on the right track. So we're finding that it's actually supporting, taking some of the pressure off specialist services and or supporting the quality of the work that we're able to do as specialist services because practitioners that already have those skills.
Absolutely. And it's incredibly powerful, isn't it, when you think about it? I think we talk a lot in education about preparing children basically for the next step, which is sort of, you know, if the child's in nursery, you know, being ready for reception, or if the child's in reception, being ready for year one or key stage one. And although, yes, those are big steps, they're only really quite small steps on the face of it, really, aren't they? Whereas when you talk about communication and language skills and the impact of developing effective communication language skills or not, that's huge. And you're talking about an impact that actually lasts a lifetime. You know, that there's such a lot of research, isn't there, that around you know, you can talk about for sort of in terms of early years education, you can talk about communication and language skills at that stage being an indicator of literacy skills by the end of the primary range. And even that's quite short in terms of time scale. But you can also talk about actually there's lots of research from EYFS through to adulthood. So adults in their 20s, late 20s, and their life chances and life skills and actually what they go on to do is impacted greatly by communication and language skills from an early age. So the work that you do must be incredibly rewarding. When you think about that one child you just talked about, you've changed their life, really, which I know sounds very dramatic, but actually you have.
You're right about the evidence base around the importance of speech and language in the early years. We know that good vocabulary at age 5 predicts just about every outcome in a person's life, not just their SATs, you know, in year 6, probably their GCSE grades, their employability and their mental health. And we know conversely, sadly, that many young people presenting at mental health services have unidentified speech, language and communication needs, and that some of the sort of difficulties and challenges in terms of employability or mental health can sometimes be linked back. It's not always causal. I'm aware it's, you know, complex, but we definitely know that having good language at age 5 is an extremely strong foundation for setting you up for not just educational outcomes, but life outcomes in terms of mental health, jobs, etc. So yeah, I mean, it is quite nice to think of that little boy in reception who, you know, we know he's had a great foundation, and I hope he's on a, you know, beginnings of a you know, a great journey ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Martin and Rachel, it's been brilliant to chat to you this morning. It's been absolutely fantastic.
There's more we could say. I mean, I know Martin obviously works in a setting, so he I don't know if you wanted to say anything.
You know, when we started on this journey, the first year when we looked at our welcome data and things was sort of around COVID, post-COVID, and we had about only 45% of our children were on track at the beginning of the year for speech, language and communication. But through the approach, through training of staff and things like that, we saw by the end of the year, almost 80% on track. So, you know, big turnaround in what we saw with our children. Yeah. And I think through this approach, it's not just the impact on the children, it's the impact on the staff as well. And the impact on the staff then obviously has impact on the children. It's just been, it's a wonderful journey to be on, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, definitely. It's been brilliant to chat to both of you. It really has. And I'm sure people listening will find what we've talked about this morning really, really interesting. And yeah, it, as I said before, it's high on the list of priorities for so many schools and settings. And yet actually we're talking about some key skills there, aren't we? We're talking about key things to think about and key things to reflect on. And developing those skills in-house to a certain extent, you know, you're supporting schools and settings to do that in-house and to develop an approach themselves, really, with that support from you. And yeah, really valuable stuff. Thank you. So there you go. Thank you very much to Martin and to Rachel for joining us this week on the podcast. And thank you, of course, as well to you people for listening along as well. And that's it from us. Take care. Have a good week, everybody. And we will see you next time.